I'm Richard, and welcome to EssetWorks podcast, You Can't Eat the Sunshine, for the week of June 24th, 2013. Join us this week as we talk with Philip Estes, regional planner for the County of Los Angeles, about preservation ordinances. We'll also talk with community advocate and gallery director Jonathan Gerald and former CRALA urban planner Donald Spivak about the unusual origins of downtown Los Angeles' arts district, the challenges that come with its growing popularity, and the human threads that are keeping it all together. So stay tuned. Los Angeles.
El Pueblo, Lotus Land, the City of Angels.
The Day of the Locust, the slide area, where all the fruits and nuts ended up when they turned the country on its ear.
But you and I were born here. Don't mind a few oddballs in the mix.
They add flavor. Growing up in Cheviot Hills, my compass pointed straight to 5th and Main.
As a kid in Hollywood, I was forbidden to take the bus to the Central Library, but I did it anyway.
Because you've got to start at the center to understand this confounding and fantastic city.
Which makes nonsense of history and breaks all the rules.
Rainer Banham said that.
He taught us well.
In the 1980s at UC Santa Cruz, now on our tours and in our time travel blogs, we're continuing the conversation.
Raymond Chandler's Los Angeles and Charles Bukowski's The Birth of Noir, Route 66, the lowdown on downtown, the real Black Dahlia.
Positive public space, endangered landmarks, forgotten lore,
memory maps, mysteries, murder,
the allocation of resources,
the hidden forces that shape public policy,
Skid Row,
Bunker Hill,
preservation,
restoration,
redevelopment.
It's a four-letter word.
Los Angeles. You can't eat the sunshine, but you can drive around and take a long, hard look.
And listen to the stories.
And pass them on. Why are we doing this again?
Because we love the place with a passion that goes beyond sense or reason.
So did Rainer Banham.
So he did. Now let's begin.
You can't eat the sunshine, but you can make a beeline for the best of the coastline. La 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 la. Skid Row, Solano Canyon, the Doria, and Pico Union, the long-lost neighborhood called Herman between South Pass and Highland Park, Grand Central Park. It is divine. Sunshine, but it's a gold mine of fabulous oddities like Brute Hairs, Dairy, Angela Savvy, Bob's Big Boy, in Downey Forest Lawn Cemetery. You can't eat the sunshine, but make a beeline for La La La. You can't eat the sunshine.
Welcome, everyone, and thank you for listening to our podcast, You Can't Eat the Sunshine, for the week of June 24th. 2013. This week, we have three guests. We'll speak with Philip Estes. He's a regional planner for the County of Los Angeles. He'll be talking about a proposed historic preservation ordinance, which he'll be drafting and putting forward to the Board of Supervisors at the end of the year. We'll be speaking with Jonathan Gerald. Jonathan is director of the District Gallery, and he's also a founding board member of the Arts District Center for the Arts, which will open in 2014 at One Santa Fe. And that's a really big deal. And we'll also be speaking with Donald Spivak. Donald Spivak was an urban planner and a policymaker for the Community Redevelopment Agency of Los Angeles from about 1982 to 2012. So he knows what he's talking about. This, well, Philip's interview is not about the Arts District, but Donald's and Jonathan Gerald's is. And so that's, we're super excited. And Philip's interview, of course, is very exciting because an historic preservation ordinance for unincorporated Los Angeles County is long overdue. Kim, it's time to talk about the Pishka.
That's right. We have a digital tip jar associated with this podcast, and we've been getting some tips from listeners, which is a lovely thing. It's very encouraging. If you want to give us a tip, you can do so on our webpage, and we will use whatever tip you give us to run around the house going, yippee, and then we'll put it in the gas tank and drive around Southern California looking for more good people to talk to. We appreciate your support and your listenership. Thank you.
Good work, Kim. All right, Kim, it's the closely watched train section. It's my favorite part of the podcast.
You never let us have a train sound, but I always hear it in my head.
Good.
Good enough.
Kim, Gail Holland, who's a really great reporter and writer for the Los Angeles Times, last week, Gail Holland wrote an article about the dissolution of the BID, the Business Improvement District, in the Arts District. And I just want to put that out there because this podcast this week is the majority of which is all about the Arts District and the mind being universal. Gail's article coincides really nicely with this podcast.
Indeed. And we'll link to that so you can get up to speed.
Kim, there's a new park. There's a new park at First and Spring. It's, there's going to be so many parks in this section.
It's a clot of parks over there, really.
Okay. The former state building, built in 1931, closed in 71 from the Sylmar quake, or soon after, demolished soon after, in like 74, 75.
Although they left the flooring.
Right.
Amazing to view aerial views.
Yes. So this foundation has stood at the intersection of First and Spring. It's the northwest corner of First and Spring, right across from the Los Angeles Times building. There's a parking garage still intact. The city has purchased the lot from the state, and they're going to turn it into a park. So that's very interesting.
And they've committed to humanely remove the cats and the kittens, because just the mere hint that there might be a scandal of bulldozed kittens was enough to get some cooperation from the city. And that's a nice thing.
Kim, the bittersweet news in East Los Angeles last week, County Board, County Supervisor Gloria Molina announced that they'd made a deal with the charter school that had purchased the First Street store to demolish the building to build a school for this charter school, but save the murals. One of the regional planners made a statement. It's a situation where everybody wins, and I would say it's a situation much like foreign policy. There are no good decisions, and there are no good outcomes, and that's how I feel. These murals, which will be saved, and hence removed from the structure in which they were placed. These murals are very interesting. Let's see. Let me get my notes.
And
out
as
here.
You do that, I'll simply mention there's Site Pacific. They were built to go into these lovely arches on the building. They look terrific there. I can't really picture what they're going to look like elsewhere, and actually doesn't seem like anyone else can yet either. This is just a promise to do something with them in the future.
Okay, so these murals, 1974, the artists on them, the lead artist is, he's still around, God bless him, Johnny Gonzalez, Roberto Arenavar, and David Botello. So they approached the owner of the store, Mr. Kemp. They actually approached him in 1968-1969, because what happened is there was another mural built in 1968, Dr. Bravo. Don't forget Dr. Bravo. Dr. Bravo had a medical clinic in Boyle Heights. He started his work under Dr. Thomas Noguchi at the morgue, so he liked to collect medical curiosities and keep them on display in his medical clinic.
Where are they now?
We don't know. The Bravo Clinic is still there, not in its original location. It used to be at 7th and Soto. It's moved a little west. Dr. Bravo was one of the financiers behind the Pan American Bank, just down the street from where the First Street store is. The bank is still there. In 1966, they commissioned a Mexican artist named Meza to create these beautiful mosaic panels about the history of a Chicano mural and just these wonderful mosaics. So at 66, Bravo and the other financiers get that up on the bank. This inspires the three artists I just talked about for the First Street mural. They approach the owner of the First Street store, Mr. Kemp, and they say, hey, we really want to do these murals. They're starting to go up. These are really great ways to talk about the Chicano movement, this rise in consciousness about our people here. The owner says, maybe the Chicano moratorium start 1970, you've got the third moratorium and the death of Ruben Salazar and the decisions made that Cesar Chavez, Whittier Boulevard was in flames in 1970. And the owner decides, we're not going to become a flashpoint for Chicano identity in murals. So it takes another 4 years. It's 1974, these murals go up.
And what occurs to me as you're telling me this story is they must have been inspired by the Home Savings Miller Cheats murals. And it's terrific to think that, you know, you're seeing these beautiful art pieces being created out of banks all over Southern California and in East Los Angeles, the local community says, we can do that, and we can tell our story. Instead of having these images of, you know, white people frolicking on the beach, which are wonderful, they tell one Southern California story. And the great thing about those Miller Cheats, mostly designed by Miller Cheats, home savings murals, is they're all different. They try to tell their own story. That's really, I don't know how I never made that connection. But of course, the bank came first.
The banks usually come first. We've only just begun. Kim, we've got an update on the Bishop's Mansion. A couple, probably like more like 6 weeks back.
It's not a happy one. Be quick.
Update. So about 6 weeks ago, we mentioned that Waha West Adams Historical.
West Adams Historical Heritage
Association had filed an appeal with the City of Los Angeles for permit being requested to be given to the Bishop's Mansion. This is a Sumner Hunt Eisen 1898 residence on Adams,
already
just
ruined,
west of Hoover. In 1920, it became a church. They built a church and connected the mansion and the church. The current owner has done a lot of work, which has really ruined what architectural cohesion existed. Waha filed an appeal to deny them permitting to continue even more work. It went before the HPOZ, the Historic Preservation Overlay Board, which oversees the area as it should, and the appeal was denied. So work will continue on the
destruction of the Bishop's Mansion. Bye.
Okay, Kim, let's get back to Park. So let's get back to parks, and we're going to jump back and forth between Los Angeles and New York, and ideally, in this hopscotch game, we're going to gain a lot of momentum in abstractions and insight. So I noticed last week that there was a vote by the New York City Parks Commission regarding a conservancy to possibly take over oversight of Washington Square Park. Washington Square Park, super important park. Just to be very quick, Jane Jacobs, an early urban advocate in the 50s, went to battle down there, and she wrote a book started writing books in the 60s, and this was a great piece for her, a great saga that she told that she won about Greenwich Village and Washington Square Park. Conservancy wants to take it over. Conservancies exist in New York as nonprofit entities outside of the City of New York's Park and Rec Department to fundraise and direct programming. If any of you are following what's happening in Pershing Square, this should start to sound all too familiar. So there was a vote about 2 weeks ago, and a lot of advocates are concerned that this nonprofit, this conservancy that wants to take over Washington Square Park, doesn't really have any credentials to be an entity in charge of raising money for the park.
They're also upset that there's been absolutely no transparency about what their intentions are, and that the commissioners just said, oh yeah, you guys are great, you're rich, you live in the neighborhood, do it.
Right. So to be very quick and bring this back home, so we have two concerns. I think the second concern fits in the bucket of the first concern. Of course, the old concern, privatization of public space. The concern is that this conservancy will have a hand in policy making in the park, which, for lack of transparency, because it's a nonprofit, is of concern to people. The second concern is that this conservancy will start to monetize this public space, which is, of course, a valid and good concern.
Sure. I mean, people love to be able to go into a park and order a cappuccino. That's not the issue. What the issue is, and why we should care about Washington Square Park, even though it's 3,000 some miles away, Washington Square Park is an incredibly important cultural creative zone. It's basically where folk music took off in America. It's where beatnik culture took off. In fact, they tried to keep the beatniks out, and the beatniks and the folkies all got together and basically took over the park en masse and said, no, this is a public place. It's fine to think in the abstract, well, no one's really using this park and it's really neglected. And I mean, that's not Washington Square, but you could certainly say that about Pershing Square because it's so disgusting at this point that it's very underused. Wow, let's just do something really special for it. But you don't realize at this moment in time what sort of cultural flashpoint creativity you may be stifling in the future by making it completely inaccessible to young creative people to gather in. Because young creative people don't know what they're going to do either until they get together in public spaces and have a chance to do things. So we're running out of public spaces. Public spaces feed our souls. Free spaces feed the life of the mind and the life of the city. And I think that often the people who want to take control of these public spaces want to do it for really bad reasons. Power, control being its own prison, and keeping people in the park out. The best way to keep the people you don't want in a park out is to create positive public space that brings more people in.
Good job, Kim. Let's now take a second and remember Henry Hope Reed, who died about 6 weeks ago. Henry Hope Reed died at 98. He became the curator of Central Park back in the 60s. Henry Hope Reed is super important. Henry Hope Reed was the guy in the 1970s who decried the director of Central Park for wanting to monetize it by starting to have concerts that actually had it right. It was just Henry Hope, very smart guy. He's been screaming up until recently about the problem of monetizing public spaces, privatizing public spaces in New York City since the 60s.
He was right.
He was dead on right. God rest his soul. Go read his obituary. Guy was an utter genius. I remember Henry Hope Reed. And in that same breath, as I remember Henry Hope Reed, Kim, I want to point the spotlight on the new park on Spring Street at 4th, which did, in fact, just open.
It did.
I can't because I said in the same breath as Henry Hope Reed, so continue and I'll get back to
that. You'll get back to this. This is the park that's next to the, are we calling it the Eldorado?
The Eldorado.
The Eldorado, sure. It's next to the Eldorado. It was going to be private space. It didn't work out that way. It ended up getting purchased by the city. They spent about $8 million developing it. It was an old parking lot. And the interesting thing that's going on there is that although the city spent, you know, an excessive amount of money, in my opinion, designing this park, because they could have just put down grass and trees, they now want to hand off the responsibility for managing and funding the park to some sort of private entity. Well, there is no such entity in place. It looked like there was going to be one coming out of, I think, Tom Gilmore's office, but there were arguments about what the park would be named, and so that group dropped out. So now a small group that seems to be comprised of president of DLANC, Patty Berman, and one of the property holders in the Eldorado building, they've started a Facebook page called, I think, Friends of the Spring Street Park, and they're in the running to develop a nonprofit under Community Partners, which is the sort of umbrella organization that handholds people who don't know how to start nonprofits to help them go through that process. And so they've been, going around the community for a while now saying, well, we're going to manage this park and we're going to get financial commitments. And they were talking about having a half million dollar 5-year commitment from American Apparel. So people were starting to think, oh, good, they actually, you know, have this in place. Well, no, they didn't actually have any money from American Apparel. American Apparel won't comment on this at all at this point. The park was rushed to open before Mayor Villaraigosa left, so it's open now. Within 3 hours of the park's opening, there was a giant firefight on the internet, mostly on Facebook.
It's called a flame war.
Well, it was a flame war. There are two things going on. One, the park has rules that are set by Parks and Rec. They're pretty pretty strict rules as rules go. I mean, they now have that new no camping rule that is on all the parks since Occupy LA camped out with permission from city council at the City Hall Park.
Kim, they're rules, though. They're part of the Los Angeles City Municipal
Code. Right. They're all cited as code. And one of the rules is dogs must be on leashes. So there's a playground in the park. Pretty big playground. There's a grassy knoll, everyone's been calling it. There's some metal benches, sort of slant-back single-seat benches. There's a lot of concrete, or, I don't know, some kind of sidewalk. And there's an issue. And the issue is, this Friends organization, which doesn't run the park and has no money to run the park, has their own set of rules that differ in certain interesting ways from the rules that have been set by Park and Rec. Most prominently, their rule is dogs are not permitted on the grass at all. Dogs are not permitted to excrete in the park. Well, no. The rules that have been set by the group that oversees the park, Parks and Rec, for the city, which purchased the park using, you know, money that the city was given by developers to develop a park. The rule is you can come in with your dog on a leash. Your dog can do its business. You should pick it up. Municipal code. So the group that wants to run the park but doesn't officially run it yet, and may not, started a campaign on their website, which seeks to encourage attendees of the park space to photograph other attendees of the park space who they consider to be violating the rules of this Friends organization, to submit them via email and post them on this Friends organization's website in order to, quote, identify them as, quote, shameful downtowners. Well, the first one went up, and it was a picture of a very unhappy-looking man shot from the back who's clearly been stalked, and someone has shoved a phone in his face. And then underneath it says, this guy thought it was fine to let his dog run around without a leash. This is our first shameful downtowner. Shame on him. Send us more photos. Well, this turned into a very contentious discussion of privacy and of positive public space and of the fact that, you know, not talking to your neighbors, but simply sneaking up behind them and taking pictures of them in order to shame, unquote, shame them on the internet is really hostile and unpleasant. And who made you the boss of me? And why is this happening? And how is this going to be a place where people can enjoy this brand new park without feeling like they're being watched and judged? And the people with kids are very upset because the level of dog waste is extremely high and it's not all getting picked up and it's, of course, all over the place. And the people with dogs are upset because they feel like the children are getting special treatment from this Friends group that doesn't actually have any power over the park. And this is what happens when a small group that has no policy experience and isn't responding to set official policies that have been proven and tried and voted on and accepted tries to make behavior be legislated. It's very, very sad. It's very immature, and it's not helping downtown show itself off as everything that it can be. So, I mean, it's fascinating, and it's kind of like watching a car wreck, but it's making me very sad.
Thank you, Kim. So I think if you asked Donald, well, actually, we do, okay, not in this episode of this podcast, but when we interviewed Donald, we did several interviews at once, and when we talked about Skid Row, an interview will air soon, I do ask him, looking back, what did you see and what did you not see coming as policy issues, specifically in Skid Row, but downtown in general, and people saw women on Skid Row as an issue in the 80s. I mean, no one knows what to do about it. But even 25, 30 years ago, people said, we need to. But no one really saw the dogs versus babies war, which is what you've just been talking about.
Well, sure. The early development of Main Street was predicated on making it a dog-friendly space. People were actually encouraged to get dogs to be part of the community. This is the result.
So we're gonna move on. Dogs versus babies.
And just, it's important to point out, some of the same people are involved in trying to take over the management of Pershing Square. Yes. And it's really important. There aren't a lot of public spaces downtown. They're obviously extremely important to the community. And it's really important that they be managed transparently, professionally, and for the good of all, not for the good of small groups who really, frankly, don't know what they're doing.
Remember Henry Hope Reed. Kim, let's talk about some upcoming events.
We've got a few. We've got, well, The Lava Sunday Salon Weekend is focused on Jazz Age Los Angeles. We hope we will see you at the Lava Sunday Salon at
Lanos de Figaro.
Why do I have so much trouble?
Because it's a French word and an Italian word. That's and just why keep on talking. Lanos de Figaro.
On Broadway, where we're going to be having on Sunday, the 30th of June, a program with Mark Chevalier and Martin Turnbull talking about their researches into, respectively, James Oviatt's attempted and failed development of a menswear shop at the corner of Crescent Heights and Sunset, and just across the street, Martin's deep research for the purpose of creating fiction into the Garden of Allah, a bungalow apartment hotel compound much beloved by the Algonquin table. Roundtable West. So that's going to be fun. The day before, our beloved Adrian Crew is hosting one of her occasional, actually two of her occasional, S. Scott Fitzgerald walking tours, and our salon speakers will be guesting with her, and it's going to be just fun galore. That's in West Hollywood. Go, go, go.
Okay, just a very quick Robert Beshley story about the demise of the Garden of Allah. I've read about this about 3 years ago and just haven't. Since we don't give tours about this place, I haven't had a chance to say it. I'm pretty sure it's apocryphal, so I'm not gonna actually write about this. But this is a great venue. Apparently, right before the Garden of Allah closed its doors, there was a gay bar operating out of the main hotel, and Beshley and his friend went to go, and they got to the door, and the doorman said, "Oh, you can only be in drag. If you go to the, you can't actually have to be dressed as, you have to be dressed as women to go into this bar." So they said, "Okay, fine, we'll be right back." And they went.
That's
up and
the kind of person you want to hang out with.
And they're just like, "Well, we've got to have one last drink at the Garden of Allah for Auld Lang Syne."
And so they threw their muumuus on, and the rest was history.
So that okay.
Thank you.
We've got Crime Lab coming up in July 14th.
We do. The Lava Crime Lab seminars are fundraisers for the Criminalistics Graduate Department at Cal State Los Angeles. If you're interested in real police work and forensic science, as told by the investigators who will walk you through their casebooks with photos and analyses of tests that they did and how things went all the way up to the courtroom, you will be blown away by this upcoming program, which I'm going to let Richard tell you all about.
Well, we're going to be talking about two cases. I'll just talk about the first case is the Universal City Walk murder. It's 96 early DNA case. This case is being discussed because of the use in court of DNA evidence, which was a milestone. Use of DNA in court, and Beverly, who is the lead forensic investigator, is just going to walk us through this really interesting case, and then Professor Don Johnson for the second case, after some great hands-on forensic lab workshops with his graduate students in their labs. Professor Johnson will go through a dog mauling case
that has
Pomona.
Very, very interesting DNA ramifications. Yeah. DNA is so poorly understood, and it's so fascinating. It's really changed the way people do police work because we're all leaving hints everywhere we go.
And Kim, last but not least, Raymond Chandler turns, well, God rest his soul.
I wish he was turning 125. That would be a party.
Raymond Chandler's birthday party is coming up Tuesday, July 23rd.
Right. We've just announced this. It was a closely held secret for a while because we wanted to get all of our little Chandler-shaped ducks in a row. We're going to gather. It's a free event, limited capacity, so keep an eye on the link for when you can start to sign up for that. It's going to be at the Los Angeles Athletic Club, which is where Chandler spent his somewhat misspent youth as an oil executive, listening to what was going on all around him as the most powerful people in Southern California schemed and hustled and conned each other and lied in that bridge room at the Los Angeles Athletic Club just across the street from the Dabney Oil Syndicate, which is where Chandler worked as an oil company vice president. We'll also be making a little visit down the road to, well, half a block away, to the Oviatt building, because, of course, Chandler, who made nothing up, drew on James Oviatt and the Oviatt building to create the sort of spider web in which his villain in The Lady in the Lake, Darris Kingsley, lived and spun his evil little schemes. So it's going to be a lot of fun. There are going to be many surprises. Some terrific people are joining us. Stay tuned.
Thank you, Kim. James Obiot is the greatest Raymond Chandler villain. I know you don't like it when I say that. I don't know why, but he is. He was, and he is.
Chandler has so many great villains.
Yeah, James Obiot is my favorite.
Okay. Well, you can say my favorite. You don't have to say the greatest. I'm not going to argue when you say my favorite anything.
He's my favorite Raymond Chandler villain.
I'm glad you have favorites.
And he's underrated, too. Okay.
He was a real son of a bitch. I mean, in real life, James Obiot used to stand with his son at the window in his penthouse apartment and say, "See that bum down there? You see him? Here's a bottle. See if you can hit him."
Lee Brackett, watch out. Okay, Kim, we got to get to these interviews.
Yes,
so,
please.
Interviews, sequence for interviews is Jonathan Gerald on District Gallery and the nonprofit he's a part of moving into the One Santa Fe space allocated for art. God, that came out really badly, but don't worry. It comes out very well. It sounds much better in the interview. Jonathan Gerald. Second interview is Philip Estes, regional planner for the County of Los Angeles, talking about he's going to be creating the ordinance and presenting it.
It's kind of his baby. And thank
he's,
you.
Council supervisors will most likely pass this ordinance pretty much by the end of the year. And when they do.
We're going to nominate the tamale.
Okay, Kim, I have to finish my sentence. When they do.
I'm sorry, I'm tamale happy.
The reason I used the personal possessive in connection with Philip and this ordinance is Philip is going to do a great deal of the administrative legwork that will be created by a historic preservation ordinance. So this is something he really, truly cares about because he's committed his work time to do this. So it's really great. It's a nice little interview about a long overdue topic. The last interview will be Donald Spivak and his decades of experience and vision in downtown Los Angeles around the Arts District. There are three great interviews. So
I venture to say there would be no downtown Los Angeles as we know it without Donald Spivak. So if you care about downtown LA, you really want to listen to this interview.
Yeah, we have a couple more interviews with Donald queued up that we're going to air soon. He's an utter genius, absolute utter genius. So let's take it our way with our interview with Jonathan Gerald. Jonathan, thank you for joining me. We're here at Angel City Brewery. We're here to talk about this great show you've curated, In Your Face. It opened last week. I want you, first of all, to introduce yourself.
My name is Jonathan Gerald. I'm a co-director of the Arts District Center for the Arts, and thank you for having me today.
You are root to this neighborhood. And this podcast, one of our series is Tracing the Development of the Arts District. Your root. We just were talking about how to start this. We agreed the best way to introduce this show would be to talk about the pickle, the pickle building, the pickle factory.
Pickle Works.
The Pickle Works. This is a building at First Street and First in Santa Fe.
First in Center. It's actually Center Street by the First Street Bridge. It's immediately adjacent to the First Street Bridge, and it was also known as the Citizens Warehouse. And for decades, it's been one of the most vibrant, exciting centers for artists, working artists in the community. Beautiful loft spaces, workspaces, and exhibition spaces, beautiful hardwood floors, brick walls, view of the river. Unfortunately, situated adjacent to the First Street Bridge, and when the city wanted to enlarge the bridge, to widen it, they bought the building, they bought out the artists, and cut off a chunk of the building in order to widen the bridge, and then left it sitting derelict. And it's really a shame because actually the Arts District was born in that building. That was the first destination that artists who were moving into the abandoned warehouses and derelict factory spaces in the deteriorating core of L.A. in the late 60s and in the 70s, that was one of the first places that was developed as a kind of wild exhibition space, an anti-establishment exhibition space where they created the drive-by gallery, the Art Dock. Many of the artists who participated in that period of time have gone on to very successful careers. Paul McCarthy, George Herms, just to name a couple. And it's a fascinating piece of history, and that's a history that's immediately relevant to this community, which is now called the Arts District because of that building.
I'm going to interrupt you just because I want to put on the table before, and we can forget about it once we say it. The Pickle Works was important because Joel Wax, who was at the time a council member in the Los Angeles City Council, he got passed an ordinance called the Artist in Residence Ordinance. And in my own personal emotional half acre and professional work, this is an incredibly important piece of public policy. So if you could just spend just 30 seconds talking about Joel and all the good work he did.
Sure. I mean, obviously, what happened in the 70s is artists moved into these warehouse spaces that they were renting for a nickel and 25 cents a square foot, turning them into workspaces and also turning them into really comfortable living spaces. But it was all illegal. And the city had to come to terms with that. And Joel was one of the key, he was the key in getting an ordinance passed that allowed people to live and work in a space that didn't have to come up to the same standards as an apartment, the AIR ordinance, the Artist in Residence ordinance. And that made a huge difference, and it really helped turn a new page in the history of the community. And fortunately, one of the things that it did is it made these spaces really attractive. And that sort of encouraged the return to the urban core of many people who were had moved to the suburbs and outlying areas. It made the city attractive again. And, of course, the rents went up, and artists began to be forced out. And one of our purposes at the Arts District Center for the Arts is to focus on the importance of this community to the culture of Los Angeles and the economy of the city as a true incubator for the arts. I mean, it's not just the crazy artists who do strange things in the street that the community, although bless their hearts, people like Frank Miller, the writer director, the guy who wrote Dances with Wolves. Gosh, I just forgot his name. Obviously, the artist John Baldessari. These are all people who came out of this milieu. And it was because they were living in close proximity in these lofts down here, and they fed off of each other, and they encouraged each other, and there was a huge explosion in the arts. And the influence of those people is still being felt today in communities around the world. Unfortunately, it seems to be the inevitable fate of arts districts that they become so interesting that they, you know, the evil word gentrification creeps in. And our strategy for dealing with that is not to fight it, but to try to find ways to evolve with it. And so, you know, creating performance spaces and exhibition spaces. One of the most important artists in the history of the community, Paul McCarthy, has returned with the Box Gallery down here. That's great. There are other really exciting venues and little theaters that celebrate the history of theater in the community, which is also huge, from the Wolfskill Theater to the Zoo District to Cornerstone Theater. All very interesting and influential parts of the arts community. So, you know, we're here at the brewery because we put an installation together. It started with Carlton Davis, who ran the art dock at the Citizens Warehouse, or the Pickle Works, for many years as a kind of anti-establishment arts exhibition space. And when I met Carlton, it was about the same time I was also getting to know Stephen Seemeyer, who was a very important part of the arts community back in the 70s, who organized things called the Red Zones, where the people would... The best story was the building that's now Verskuka was a print shop. And one day, Stephen and his cohorts were hanging around until the printer went home, and then when he locked up and went away, they rushed out with vats of red paint, painted the entire building red, and created a performance event against the side of the building. I think Stephen made a silhouette of himself out of meat, which was very popular with the local dogs. And performance artist Skip Arnold had himself saran-wrapped naked to a phone pole. And there were some other events there that I think Stephen will want to tell you about later on. But that was the first, I think, of the Red Zones, and that was an interesting period in the evolution of performance art. And people like Alan Capra were part of that scene, and this was an important center for it. And we're hoping that we can echo that in some of the things that we're doing and that we have planned. But so Stephen Seemeyer is also part of the show. We have illustrations from the Art Doc. We have almost a full-sized print of one of the installations. Stephen Seemeyer's collages are from his movie The Young Turks, which celebrates the art scene in downtown L.A. in the 80s. And then the other part of the installation is, of course, Irving Greyness's wonderful photos looking at the constantly changing walls around the American Hotel on Hewitt at Traction. And the thing about those walls, I mean, part of the charm is its transience, is the fact that it's changing all the time. And I think that he's done an excellent job sort of capturing the sensibility of those walls. It's interesting because people have very strong feelings. There are the people who put the work up who I think are in love with their own work, would like to see it up forever. And then there are people who paste on top of it. And it becomes a dialogue between the artists. And over time, there's sort of a kind of etiquette has evolved where people respect a new piece of work for a certain period of time, and then when it starts to look old, people feel free to put something new and cover it up. And so you get this thick layering of images, which is kind of a dialogue in itself. And it's a wonderful way of watching as time changes across the community. And Irving has done a great job of documenting that.
Fantastic. So this is a great overview of the show. And that's a great step at trying to sort of delineate the problem space, which is the arts district in the 80s and 90s, which we will continue to talk to you and others about. I wanna wrap this up. I want to throw in your lap the notion that I just want you to sort of toss around and run up the flagpole and see what you think of it. But the whole notion of arts as an economic engine. And I believe that Rocco Landsdow, who's now the former head of the National Endowment for the Arts, 3 or 4 years back started using that expression. So I'm gonna toss that in your lap, and maybe you can let us know what you think about that.
Well, it's a tricky notion because, of course, I think people who are... I don't think anybody who's really compelled to make art is compelled by a need to earn a living. I think, you know artists and I know artists who really can't do anything else. It's part of their nature to do art, and that's what they do. But there are other artists, I think, who are more successful in knowing how to market themselves. And, of course, we live in Los Angeles. This is the largest producer of mass media in the world. And feeding that machine, that creative machine, is a constant problem. Excuse me while I just turn that off. So, I think all these artists, and many of the artists that work in this community also work in the film industry and in television. They're art directors. They work on sets. And they also work in electronic media. They work in e-graphics of all kinds. And I think that's part of the mix. I think, you know, it's awfully hard to draw a line between what is commercial art and what is so-called high art. I like David Bowie's phrase, what is it? His mission was to drag high art down into the streets. And I think, you know, that's part of what a community like this is all about, which has always been defined by its sort of youthful vigor and its anti-establishment approach to the arts. A lot of people down here sort of think that Red Cat, for example, is a very noble endeavor, but it's awfully hard to be the anti-establishment arts organization in the belly of the beast in the basement of Disney Hall. So I think, you know, it's a very tough question because the commercialization of art is something that has always happened, will continue to happen. I mean, we can talk about it whether it's happening in mass media or whether it's the gallery system. I think part of what this community is all about is a rebellion against the gallery system that was part of the youth rebellion of the 60s, in which artists didn't want to be constrained by gallerists and critics, and they wanted to reach their audience without that mediation. And so they went to the walls, and that's why we have all these wonderful murals that we have now. In the early days, it was people were still groping towards what it would be all about, and that those artists who were working in primarily graffiti, many of them emerged as some of the most successful artists in the world today, like Banksy, who was a common graffiti artist in the beginning. That's right. And, you know, Shepard Fairey started off with images that were relatively crude compared to the incredibly sophisticated stuff that he does today. And I think a lot of people, and I think Shepard Fairey is, you know, if you want to talk about that conflict or that problem of what is commercial art and what is pure art, I mean, poor Shepard Fairey is always stuck in the middle of that. I think his impulse is to be a really wonderful artist, but I think, you know, he's also a brilliant businessman. And I think there are lots of artists who have been like that throughout their careers. Yeah.
That was fantastic. That's a very good attempt to answer a question that has no good answer.
Exactly.
there's no good answer. So there's no right answer. And yours is very good. So, bravo. Thank you for talking to us about this show. Before we go, why don't you just once again, people are aware of the exhibit in your face. It'll be open through the first week of June. Give us just another minute on your nonprofit again, just so people sure. can get their heads around it and what you're offering down here too, because your gallery is just across the street.
That's right. Our gallery, the District or D Gallery, is just across the street at 740 East 3rd Street near the corner of Traction. It's a very small demonstration space. That is an attempt to bring emerging Los Angeles urban artists to the attention of the public, to find an audience for their work, and to bring in artists from other urban areas to help fertilize the creative ground. And to that end, the nonprofit that we created, Los Angeles Downtown Arts District Space, has its goal the creation of an arts district center for the arts, which will open in about a year and a half at One Santa Fe. And I can't tell you more about it right now. Later on, you'll hear some news about it. But it's very exciting, and it's the best strategy that we can figure to preserve the area as a true arts district. Now, the other thing that's happening with that is that together with Cultural Affairs and the developer of One Santa Fe, we're putting in 88 units of affordable artist housing, which is a big challenge. It's a challenge for the city because you have to come up with an ordinance that allows you to give preference to artists in affordable housing, and that's something that the council district is grappling with now. So the artist housing, hopefully the restoration of some other buildings to artist buildings in the community will continue to allow this community to thrive as a true arts community.
Perfect. I want to thank you for joining us, Jonathan, and we'll see you soon.
Thank you.
This is Fanny Bixby in Old Long Beach. You're listening to You Can't Eat the Sunshine.
Thank you for joining us. We're here with you at the County Hall of Records at Hill and Temple, and I'd love for you to introduce yourself, and then we'll get started on what we're going to talk about with you today.
Hi, my name is Philip Estes, and I'm a principal planner with the County of Los Angeles Department of Regional Planning.
Wonderful. Philip, we're here for you to tell us today about something really exciting for us preservationists that happened at the Board of Supervisors meeting yesterday. Do you want to tell us about the Mills Act Ordinance, which is now a law in the County of Los Angeles?
Sure. At yesterday's Board of Supervisors meeting, the county adopted its very own Mills Act Ordinance for the unincorporated areas of Los Angeles County.
Okay, great. So, to diehard preservationists, everyone's jumping up and down now. And to those that are interested but don't know the nuts and bolts, tell us what this means, what the Mills Act means for structures of historic significance in unincorporated parts of Los Angeles County.
Sure. The Mills Act is considered by many to be the most significant economic incentive program for the restoration and preservation of historic properties in the state of California. What this means is that property owners of eligible and designated landmarks would be able to enter into a contract with the county, and in that contract would stipulate how that building would be protected and preserved. And in exchange for that contract, the assessor would reassess the property, and that may result in a lower property tax rate. And the tax rate can be significant. We've heard some jurisdictions the tax bill is lowered by 40 to 50%.
Wow, great. So it's not
guaranteed, no. but that's what people generally see.
Yeah. Wonderful. So this Mills Act, this is part of a larger notion of an historic preservation ordinance in unincorporated Los Angeles County. Before we get into looking ahead to what might be next, I just want to quickly review, just because we talked to Ken Bernstein, who's the principal planner for the city of Los Angeles. He did a great job talking about the different tools for historic preservation at a municipal level within the city of Los Angeles. Mills Act was one of them. Another, I guess we're going to get to our second part by what I'm about to say right now. Another tool the city of Los Angeles has is its cultural landmark status. And between the Mills Act and the HCM, Historic Cultural Monuments, Ken is able, and Historic Preservation Overlay Zones, which is farther along, those are really the base on which preservation in the city of Los Angeles is done. I'm wondering, the Mills Act is now been passed by the Board of Supervisors. If you could just, I know there's a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes, if you could just briefly look ahead to what is seen as the second part of a more overarching historic preservation ordinance, which I think at least some of the Board of Supervisors have been looking to for a while.
Yes, so our next step is to prepare a local historic preservation ordinance, which would enable the county board to designate local landmarks. Right now, the county doesn't have that mechanism to designate local landmarks. So the only determination or the only designation in the county right now are National Register properties and State Register properties. So that is our next step, is to develop a local preservation ordinance, and we're in the very early stages of that. Right now, we're writing a discussion draft and looking forward to going out to the community to present that and get some response from that. But our goal is towards the end of this year to present an ordinance to the Board of Supervisors for their consideration.
That's fantastic. That's absolutely fantastic. So we will keep people posted through our podcast and social media channels, because you're going to have discussion, community outreach about this. Is this going to take place in meetings, or are you just going to make stuff publicly available as PDFs?
We're considering actually doing some actual events, community outreach, and also exploring some online interactive approaches.
Great. Wow. Okay. We're very, very, very excited. So soon, ideally in the next couple of years, there'll be a growing list of landmarks in the county of Los Angeles. And I just so we can wrap this up, I'm wondering if you have a landmark in the county of Los Angeles that a favorite. I don't want you to play favorites necessarily, but I don't want to also walk through the whole list, because that would be kind of dry and we'd run out of time. Do you have one in particular you'd like people to remember as a county landmark?
Well, I don't know if I could say I have an absolute favorite, but if you insist...
I do.
You insist, okay. In the unincorporated areas, there's one that sticks in my mind, is the Christmas Tree Lane, which is a really unique place, and it's a designated National Register Historic Landmark, but it's not a building or any type of structure. It's a natural feature, and it's really quite beautiful. The trees are very old, and it is really a unique place in the county at it. That's one of my favorites.
Perfect. So when everyone goes there for Christmas this year, they can think about the expanding reach of county landmarks. This has been fantastic. I want to thank you. I'm really excited. I want to thank you for all the good work you're doing. We're going to keep everyone posted. If you have public meetings, we'll get everyone to come. All of ModCom, we'll get everyone, the whole nine yards. So thank you so much.
Okay, thank you, Richard.
This is Daryl. I'm at the Los Angeles Times building, and I'm on You Can't Eat the Sunshine.
Dawn, I want to thank you for joining us today here in downtown. We're going to talk about the Arts District. And before we do that, I would love for you to introduce yourself properly and just give us a sense of why we've decided to talk to you today.
Okay, good morning. My name is Don Spivak. I was the head of the policy planning unit of the Community Redevelopment Agency for several years, and prior to that was the project manager, project director for many of the downtown redevelopment areas in Los Angeles. So I worked on a number of both specific projects and on policies, including the city's industrial land use policy, that had a major influence on where things are now hopefully beginning to move more smoothly in the Artist District and the surrounding industrial areas.
Wonderful. Great. So you're the guy. We're going to start this interview with the Pickleworks building, which is just at the foot of the First Street Bridge on the north side of the First Street Bridge. So, tell us a little bit about this building. We agreed we'd start with connecting this building to the ordinance artists in residence ordinance, and this will just sort of, and we're gonna give us a date, and then you'll just start talking about this building.
The building is one of several buildings that, over the course of many years, artists moved into. It, like many other buildings in that portion of downtown Los Angeles, was a building that was designed for industrial use, a multi-story building, that as industrial processes changed became obsolete. And as a result, it, along with other buildings, were vacant from industrial purposes. Artists discovered the space as being available starting in the 1970s and 1980s and began moving into the area. Creating an artist district in a very informal way. Many of the artists in this building were among those who tried to organize to legitimize the artist district. It didn't work the first time around, and several of them left the district and reassembled in the district in the 1990s, where they again moved very strongly to try to legitimize the district. And two things happened as a result of that. Council member at the time, Joel Wax, was instrumental in moving this through city council. One was the adoption of an amendment to the zoning ordinance that created the work-live quarters, or artist loft concept, as a legal way of addressing the use of these kinds of buildings. It only applied in industrial zones. And the second was an amendment in 2000 to the Central City North Community Plan that, for the first time, created an artist-in-residence district with a specific boundary, the idea being that this was the area to target for growing an artist district. People could both live and work and perform their arts, bring in other types of uses, coffee houses, galleries, and things that would support this community in that district.
Boundaries of this district, if just only roughly?
The boundaries were roughly First Street on the north, 6th Street on the south, Alameda Street on the west, and the Los Angeles River on the east.
Fantastic! Great. So we've got an area that's been designated that can transition from industrial to other uses. Do you want to then talk about the challenges as an urban planner that you're faced with this challenge to go from artists are living there, you want to legitimize it. So tell us what you think when you start thinking about converting zoning of a lot from industrial to residential to commercial to just to any other use.
There are a number of challenges. The first is finding buildings that are really suitable. And under the ordinance, a building has to be documentably no longer suitable for manufacturing use to be eligible for conversion. The second issue that really needs to be looked at, and this is something the city did not do a very good job of, is you have to look beyond an individual building. You have to look at the neighbors of that building and see that if you allow a conversion of a particular building to residential, and you now have people living in that building, what are the impacts on the active industrial uses that surround it? And the types of industrial uses that predominated in the area and continue to be important to the economy of the city are very much related to seafood and other food products, which means that there are odors, it means that there are trucks, it means that there is activity throughout the night. And so the level of activity was something that residents, once they began to settle in the area, would complain about. So as an area became residential, and frequently just with a single residential building on a block, you now had a constituency that would complain about noise and complain about trucks and complain about odors, and the city's reaction was to clamp down on the industrial uses. So that encouraged a lot of them to shut down or to move out of the area. In about 2005, 2006, the city realized that there was a growing loss of industrial use and the jobs from the city of Los Angeles. We did some calculations and found out over the prior 10 or 15 years, we had gained about 1 million people living in Los Angeles, but net lost 50,000 jobs in the same time period. So not only were we not keeping up with population growth, we were falling further and further behind in terms of our job creation. And industrial jobs tend to pay better and tend to have better working conditions than retail and service jobs, and tend also to be jobs that don't require, at least at that time, high educational levels. So they were the kinds of jobs that people in the city, particularly people in nearby neighborhoods, could fill. So the impact of kind of random conversion of buildings was driving a lot of industrial uses out. More than that, it was creating a population that was not really very well concentrated, that was demanding shops and demanding markets and demanding parks and so forth, but there wasn't enough of a cluster to find a good location for these. On top of the fact that because the city had designated these areas for industrial, they never in the capital programs anticipated sidewalks and cafes and parks and schools that were now being demanded in competition with other parts of the city that were programmed for residential development. So all of these conflicts came to a head in 2006, 2007. A series of public workshops were held, and the city came out with an industrial policy that said, go back to the general plan, which said industrial areas ought to be industrial and non-industrial areas can be residential, commercial. Only 8% of the city to begin with was zoned industrial, so you have 92% of the city to do anything else that you wanted. That itself didn't really solve the problem because you still had a sizable population living in this area. So ultimately the decision was made, let's expand the artist district, let's designate a new set of boundaries, focus the residential conversions within that boundary so you began to move toward a sufficient cluster of population to justify both private and public investment in the area, enough of a population to support markets and cafes and things like that, and to justify the public improvements, and at the same time say we will not allow additional residential development outside that boundary so that an investor who is interested in industrial retention would feel secure if they put investment into an industrial building, would not be threatened by conversion of nearby buildings in the future.
That's absolutely fantastic. I want to thank you for saying that, because we're just, every day in our news readers, we just get, there's just, everyone's interested in the Arts District, and that was just a really wonderful grounding. So let's, keeping the theme of things that show up in my Google news reader in the last 2 weeks, would you mind giving us a weather report for the Arts District? It's June 2013. You know what you're talking about, man. Why don't you just shoot straight from the hip and tell us what you see and what you're thinking about and what you're looking for and what you're not looking for.
Okay, there are a couple things. One, the artist district is evolving kind of in two directions. They're clearly the direction of the people who are artists or consider themselves to be artists and artisans, who are really the target population for that area. And they're looking to preserve a very strongly arts-oriented district with a certain physical sense that is urban gritty, if you will. You know, the kind of environment that is primarily industrial buildings in an area that doesn't have suburban niceties. And at the same time, you have a growing population that's looking to move into the area as part of the downtown residential boom, who sees this as an attractive place to live, partly because of the grittiness that physically exists, but don't want it to be gritty. And so they're looking for supermarkets, and they're looking for streetscapes, and they're looking for trees and parks and things of that nature. So internally, there's a conflict in the population in terms of what does the area want to be as it grows up. The other, another piece of it is that the artist community is a growing piece of the economy of Los Angeles that we certainly want to better recognize and endorse, and do it in the context of the overall rebirth of downtown Los Angeles. Downtown Los Angeles is evolving with a number of new districts. The office functions that had traditionally been here are slowly starting to come back. They've been relatively stagnant for a long period of time. It's becoming much more of a visitor and tourist destination, and so promoting the distinctive nature of different communities in downtown, both as a means of attracting people to live in its different neighborhoods and to visit its different neighborhoods, is really important to the economy. The Artist District is kind of now emerging as the center of what you might want to call the creative arts or the creative technology center of Los Angeles. And this ties into to an earlier concept, which is to create a clean tech corridor, which was very much the idea of taking a number of these smaller industrial buildings and move them in the direction of new technologies, with the understanding that this district physically could be the place where you incubated businesses, where people could live and work and develop these ideas, get them patented, easy access to the academic institutions that surround the district. You're very, very close to USC. You're not far from JPL, Caltech. You're a little bit further from UCLA, but it's not a bad shot. So you've got a very central location that also has the amenities of downtown Los Angeles, the restaurants and the hotels and things of that nature. The communities such as Little Tokyo and Chinatown that are evolving in their own kind of ethnic right, that is promoting a better understanding of their own history and capitalizing on that as a mechanism for economic development, and the potential to tie into the revitalization of the Los Angeles River as a major amenity that would support the growth of this type of middle to higher middle income entrepreneurial population that these buildings would be suited for as an adjunct to other communities such as Boyle Heights, Pico Union, from which they could continue to draw and possibly draw more of a workforce in the support functions for the industry. So there are these possibilities of growing it as an artist district, growing it as a creative arts and technology district, and having it serve that role as part of the evolving and growing greater downtown Los Angeles.
You knocked it out of the park, man. You just did it. Kim, you knocked it out of the park. Thank you. I will mention in passing what you just described as what these entrepreneurial businesses in the clean tech corridor need: access to Caltech, UCLA, USC. This perfectly describes what Kim and I do every day. And yet we run a bus tour company. I want to thank you. This has been absolutely wonderful. We're gonna have you back to talk about more neighborhoods in downtown.
Fine. Thank you very much. It's been my pleasure.
Hi, my name is Jackie Miller, and I'm here at the parsonage of Amy Semple McPherson, better known to you as Sister, and you're listening to You Can't Eat the Sunshine.
And we're done. I want to thank everyone for listening to our podcast, You Can't Eat the Sunshine, for the week of June 24th, 2013. Our guests this week were Jonathan Gerald of District Gallery, Philip Estes, Regional Planner for the County of Los Angeles, and Donald Spivak, an urban planner for the former Community Redevelopment Agency of Los Angeles. I want to thank you for listening. And Kim, if people want to reach out to us and give us some feedback about the series, about an interview in particular, how can they do that?
They can come and see us at an event, of which there'll be some links below all of this text. You can also send us an email. youcaneatthesunshine@gmail.com works. So does the contact link at www.esoteric.com. We love to hear from you.
Perfect. Okay, let's just quickly get through some upcoming bus tours and other events. July 13, that is
that's after 4th of July. That's the first weekend after 4th of July. We've got my Charles Bukowski bus tour. That's a lot of fun. You have a look like I've forgotten something.
No, it just amazes me that we actually have a few days off. I'm thinking maybe we'll do something fun. We'll go out and...
You're going away.
Yeah, I have a little project involving the Musée Mécanique in San Francisco, of which more later. But, no, it's good. I'll be glad to get on the bus and do some literary tours. We're going to be doing the Bukowski tour. We're going to have this wonderful birthday party for Raymond Chandler. And also, in July, we're going to be going out on The Birth of Noir, which is also a Chandler-themed tour in its way. It's about Jamie Caine, but it's also about the making of Double Indemnity, which, of course, Raymond Chandler was deeply involved in. And so... much looking forward to that as well. We have, at the end of the month, a now nearly sold-out Real Black Dahlia tour. It's our most popular tour. It does always fill up quickly. So if you've been thinking about walking in the footsteps of Elizabeth Short and finding out what it meant to be at the corner of 6th and Los Angeles Street with a dollar in your pocket in January of 1947, which was potentially a wonderful place to be, but in her case, a very, very dangerous one, you want to get on that bus.
You did it, Kim. You pretty much wrapped up July in a nice bow and put it on the table. I want to look ahead just with one last breath. I want to just look ahead to August. August is traditionally, and this year is no exception, my California Culture Series month. We do them in February and August. So just to give you a hint, Sunday, August 4, is my South LA architecture tour. And this... is a tour, however mundane its name, South LA. It is about the creation of California as a it is a tour about how California came to be a creative engine for design. Modernism, hot rods, aerospace.
Googie.
It's all there. It's you have no idea. You have no idea how interesting this tour is in places which many Angelenos traditionally would associate with mundane and just not terribly interesting.
Freeway flyover country.
Right.
But it's not. You just have to know where to go.
Maywood, Vernon, Santa Fe Springs, Downey. It's all there.
We've only just begun.
Sunday, August 4th. And
one of our rare Sunday tours. So some of you can only get on the bus on Sunday. We know that.
Okay. So there we go. So that's our look ahead. I want to thank you for listening. I want to encourage you to continue to listen, and I want to remind you...
you can't eat the sunshine.
You can't eat the sunshine, but you can make a beeline for the best of the coastline. La, 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 la. Skid Row, Solano Canyon, the Doria, and Pico Union, the long-lost neighborhood, called Herman between a South Pass and Highland Park, Grand Central Park. Sunshine, but it's a gold mine.